Event didn't come out in isolation. We also had other scientific media-related issues as related to the pandemic. For example, should we use masks? How deadly is this? How should we change our behaviors? All this was also discussed in the scientific community as well. Should we close schools? All this was discussed in the scientific community and in the media, and there was opposition to the Trump administration as well. So we have to think about it in context. It wasn't just in isolation. How do you think about this issue as it relates to the other issues that were discussed both in science and media as we were desperately trying to figure out what to do?
There's this notion in the science of how institutions respond to disasters that's called elite panic. After an earthquake or all kinds of natural disasters or man-made disasters, there's often an assumption that the public's going to do the wrong thing, and we need to make sure we're all organized in law enforcement and everything else to prevent panic, prevent people running around and making the problem worse. And so in a sense, the elites, the people who are in charge, who we trust to help us, they panic and they worry more about the public's reaction than the real problem at hand. We see this again and again. And we saw it with the COVID-19 panic, the COVID-19 pandemic. There was a very ingrained assumption that people would do the wrong thing. So they would hoard masks. So we'll tell them, no, masks don't work. You know, it was better to lie to the public in order to protect the supply of PPE than to be honest and just explain with a little bit of nuance why it's more important for people in the hospitals to have masks right now than, the general public. That was an early example, but a lot of people who are skeptical of institutions constantly bring that up. It's like, well, how can we trust them? They told us masks didn't work. Those errors of messaging and self-contradiction on the part of our public health authorities were a really big problem. It's continuing to this day with information that is contradictory or sometimes somewhat exaggerated. One of the big temptations is to try to scare people into compliance with what we hope they will do. And I think we're seeing some of that today with the Delta variant. So, and then the media doubles down. The media will take a statement that might be a little bit too strong from a public health official, and they will amplify it even more in ways that I think are not helpful. They're not honest, but they're also not helpful, because sooner or later the public just kind of tunes out to the point where if they don't trust you about masks, then later they might not trust you about vaccines. And we're seeing the devastating impact of that vaccine hesitancy today. Some of it is deep-seated in our culture, but some of it was encouraged, or a situation that was unfortunately amplified both by the public officials and then, certainly there's irresponsible politicians on both sides who tend to make this stuff worse.
What's weird about this example, as a contrast to the math story you just gave, is that it wasn't really coming from public health officials that the Chinese lab leak theory was untrue. It was coming from Lancet, for example, or the New York Times.
Well, it came from both. I mean, we had the World Health Organization was also poo-pooing this, and so it was a kind of an unhealthy feedback loop that intensified the whole idea that this topic wasn't just highly unlikely but out of bounds, and the implication was the only people who would bring it up are bringing it up for a political reason, which might have been true in some cases. That's the paradox of these things. There were certainly people who, for political reasons wanted to badmouth China, but that in itself doesn't really tell you anything about the truth or falsehood of a certain hypothesis.
So let's talk about the WHO for a sec. This is an organization that didn't originally include China, and then China joined the organization. The WHO sent a team to China to investigate the situation, but they were very deferential and obsequious, it seemed, as it was recently shown in the media in the United States. How should we, and then, you know, Trump was making declarations that we should potentially leave the WHO if they can't do their job properly. And then, you know, the idea in the media was, you know, how could we be even considering leaving the WHO in the middle of a global pandemic? What did we learn about the WHO? Were they deferential to the Chinese? Did it do its job as an investigative unit, or was it never had a chance because the Chinese weren't going to allow it? How should we think about WHO as our leading health organization internationally?
Yeah, all those questions are really important and all mixed up in a way that does not lead to an easy answer. Yes, it's really important to have an institution like the World Health Organization to share data and coordinate responses to pandemics, and they've done a lot of good work over the years. But China is is the 800-pound gorilla in any organization. Tedros, his full name is almost unpronounceable to me, so everybody just calls him Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, was really obsequious to China in the early days. The organization, as you said, when a team was sent to Wuhan to investigate the origin, they were given very, very little access, and they didn't push back very much. The Wuhan Institute took their massive database of genomic data on all these bat viruses. I should rewind a little bit for those who don't know. The Wuhan Institute of Virology is famous as the world's top institution to study certain types of bat viruses that are found in China, which have been linked to other illnesses. So it's the idea that a pandemic caused by a virus that looks a lot like bat viruses came out of the Wuhan Institute is not much of a stretch when if you're just looking for correlation. Now, correlation is not causation, but it does. But it's also, it doesn't mean it's something that you completely ignore. So when they sent that team to the lab shut down all of their, they refused to give access to all the data. And Peter Daszak, who I mentioned earlier, he was later quoted saying, well, that's not a big deal. We kind of knew what was in there. That's okay. But it's not okay. This is ridiculous in the middle of a global health crisis to shut down the database that may hold the answers. And that kind of research is the thing that is what science does very well in a very distributed way. It's good to have hundreds of scientists around the world looking into that database in different ways and studying it. And that's exactly what China did not allow. So the World Health Organization did a bad job of using whatever muscle it might have had. The people on the team, the investigatory team, did not complain enough about really being subjected to kind of a whitewash. And so that is very troubling. On the other hand, in 2021, the World Health Organization actually finally kind of turned a corner on this, and Tedros himself said that he thought the lab leak theory needed to be studied more thoroughly and that China had not been fully cooperative. So he showed some spine, but we lost about a year of study. We lost about a year of research at a time when scientists all over the world were working 18 hours a day, all these different fields, scientists doing heroic work in any way they could make a contribution on this pandemic. This one really key question was kind of held off limits. And the failure of the World Health Organization and other institutions to keep that line of inquiry open, I think we will look back and see this as a dark day, not just for science, but for the field of public health in general.
Let's spend a second and be armchair scientists for a second. I know you're not an epidemiologist, but as you've read the leading scientists who believe the Wuhan theory, what arguments do they provide that give you pause that suggest that potentially the Wuhan lab leak is real? And to quote your other buddy who said, how I learned to love the Wuhan lab big theory.
Right. Well, there's sort of two sets of evidence. One is circumstantial, and that would be the absence of any, they have not found any reservoir in the natural world for this virus. The Wuhan Institute was studying some viruses from a particular cave that looked somewhat similar to this virus, and we know that particular cave or mine, there were actually some people who were cleaning up bat droppings, got infected, and years ago with a respiratory ailment. So there's a circumstantial evidence that we haven't found a natural reservoir. We do know that Wuhan was investigating somewhat similar viruses and had those at the lab. And then, so theory one could be that it's a natural virus, but we don't have the genome identified, but it is something that the lab was studying and you know, a lab worker got infected or somehow the virus got out and got into the population. That seems, you know, quite plausible. The related idea is that the lab was doing gain of function research, manipulating the virus in ways to make it more infectious. And the argument for doing that is that we can perhaps predict ways that this virus might naturally evolve that would make it more dangerous. If we make those changes ourselves and see how dangerous it is, then maybe we'll know better how to fight it if this happens. We could make a vaccine in advance, in theory. That's the rationale for the gain of function research. There's a guy at Rutgers who calls that that's the equivalent of looking for a gas leak with a lighted match. Because, you know, these labs do not have a great record of safety, even though the Wuhan lab was supposed to be a level four biosafety lab, which means, you know, everything is completely controlled with negative pressure and special suits. It turns out they were doing a lot of their research at its level three or level two levels of biosecurity. Level two would be more similar to what you would have at your dentist's office. So, you know, the idea that this lab was absolutely bomb-proof, there's no way anything could leak. You heard that a lot in the press in the early months of pushing back against this hypothesis. It wasn't true. The lab was not that secure. No, these labs do not have a great record of security. Other epidemics have been caused by leaks from labs. So it's not a crazy, wild conspiracy theory to worry about it. And I think what we're seeing with the Wuhan lab is this whole set of circumstantial evidence is persuasive. It's far from an open and shut case. But then there's also the genetic evidence, and this is a very arcane discussion about this particular spike protein that the virus has that allows it to bond to human cells and get its genetic material into the cell. There's a particular genetic sequence related to that spike protein that some researchers say is extremely uncommon or unheard of in nature, but one that's commonly manipulated by people doing this gain of function research. It's a little chunk of DNA that's easy to insert and manipulate. So therefore it's commonly done. So when some people saw that particular piece of the code, one virologist initially said that was he called it a smoking gun. That was David Baltimore. He has since walked that statement back a little bit. But a lot of people saw that and said, wow, this really looks like an insertion, a man-made insertion in the code in order to make this virus more virulent. Others have come back and said, no, this is possible in nature. It's not that uncommon. You know, I'm not qualified to answer the question, but I think it's fascinating that it took so long for the question to be asked, because the genetic sequence of the virus was released in January 2020 by a very brave Chinese researcher who thought it was important for the world to get their hands on it. The fact that he released that sequence was why we were able to create these vaccines so quickly. So that's a positive thing. But the negative part is that this important question, which is, you know, above my pay grade to be able to answer, but I think it's, you know, nothing could be more crucial, got kind of put on the back burner for roughly a year. Not entirely, because there were people who were looking into it, but it was pretty much absent from the pages of major.
Let me try a different line of questioning. And that is the role of the mainstream media versus alternative media. And you've kind of described, you know, a number of journalists outside of the mainstream media who really challenged this question and challenged. And it did not come from internal. And it reminds me a little bit of the autobiography by Seymour Hersh, the former New York Times and then independent investigative journalist. And in that book and when I met him in person, what he emphasizes is that real difficult, challenging investigative journalism is rarely done by the mainstream media and has to be done on the outside. And he did his work on various aspects of the Vietnam War and, you know, various massacres that occurred there. And so should we be surprised that it seems almost random, a former New York Times guy working at independently writing for a medium, which is I've never even heard of, Vanity Fair, which is a completely unlikely source for material like this. But going forward, should we expect blogs and podcasts and independent sleuths and investigative journalism to be not done by mainstream media, but be done on the outside? And maybe we should just embrace it and say this is the way investigative journalism will work going forward.
Yeah, and I think that's a very dangerous assumption. And I have to say, like, it's easy to say that really long-term, in-depth investigative work typically happens outside of mainstream institutions. But Hersh's, you know, long after the New York Times, Hersh's work was published for decades in the New Yorker. They could afford to pay him, you know, what if he worked on a story for a year, they would pay that. They would pay for him to do that, you know. And unless you're independently wealthy, nobody can work for a year on a story and travel around the world and publish it on their blog. You know, it's there's probably a whole different episode could be done about the rise of Medium and Substack and the ways that they are creating revenue streams for a small number of really interesting, provocative journalists, many of whom are, you know, challenge the mainstream views on a lot of issues. That's a great story, and it's exciting what's happening there. But there, I don't think there's a substitute for the kind of old school reporting team, whether, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, or what have you, spending the weeks and months on a story and being backed up by the resources of a journalistic organization, backed up I've been involved in a number of cases where you needed to make sure you had the legal team to support you because, you know, people start threatening to sue you. When I covered entertainment, we covered cases of sexual harassment and sexual abuse in entertainment companies. And boy, you don't want to go down that road without a legal team that's really ready to fight for you. Well, an independent writer just isn't going to have that. So I'm kind of heartbroken at the way that our leading journalistic institutions have pulled back from the mission of sort of fearlessly chasing the truth. And all too often, their interest in a story depends on making sure that it helps the right side. You know, and I'm not saying that they think that they're not telling the truth or they think they're hiding things. I don't think they think that. But, you know, they perceive the lab leak story as something that would help Trump politically. And that to them was a bigger problem than whether or not it was true.
And just to follow that up, when Biden turned against that idea and said, I'm going to have a full-scale investigation, was he attacked or challenged by any?
No, nothing like that. I mean, there were people who, a lot of people said, well, now we can finally look into it. We couldn't look into it before. It was too. It was too. Trump just made that everything so toxic that we couldn't. It just well, there's no way we could look at it before. I mean, there were journalists who were literally like went on Twitter and said that. And here's the paradox part. Trump did mess everything up. I mean, Trump brought so much chaos into every discussion that all kinds of institutions that would have, might have functioned better, wound up, trying to anticipate what he's going to say or push back or not wanting to get involved and not, and the people who partly hold Trump responsible for some of this, they're not entirely wrong, but I think scientists and journalists should be made of tougher stuff. They shouldn't avoid a story just because Trump mentioned it.
In some ways, this is not just a domestic event. This is an international event, and we have global institutions. We have global media institutions, global investigative journalists. We've got global health organizations. We've got global medical and scientific communities. All right, if the United States dropped the ball specifically on this one issue, and with Operation Warp Speed, we were able to get all these vaccines out. So we did some things right, some things wrong as institutions. Why do you think the international institutions failed us as well, non-US?
Yeah. Well, I mean, similar. It wasn't all Trump. There was there is a generalized fear of right-wing populism among elite institutions. So, you might have seen some of that, not just here, but around the world. Let's not give the isolationists and the xenophobes any ammunition. I think there might have been some of that. But when it comes to the World Health Organization, you see the enormous power of China and a certain shamelessness. When that team from the World Health Organization went to Wuhan, China threw out a theory. Well, maybe it didn't come from the wet market. We don't think it came from the wet market. We think it came in on some shipments of frozen fish from somewhere else.
Vietnam or something.
Yeah, and the so the World Health Organization people dutifully had to include this absurd idea that the virus might have come in on frozen. They didn't endorse it, but the very fact that they included this theory with no evidence was kind of a symbol of their willingness to kowtow. And then later, China said, "Well, no, maybe it came from there was some kind of athletic competition involving athletes involved various militaries around the world, and some U.S. military athletes had been in Wuhan, I think in September or October of that year. So no, they must have brought it. It must have come from the U.S." Just this kind of shameless finger pointing, conspiracy kind of thinking from the highest levels of the Chinese government. And there's a brazenness in their actions, and they know that people overseas might not believe that, but they also know that in their domestic politics, this might be all people hear. They'll have no reason not to believe the theories that the Chinese government puts forward because they have such control over the media. With the way that China clamped down on its domestic media covering any of these issues was staggering. I mean, they had hundreds of censors working daily to make sure that the wrong, what they would consider the wrong information about COVID did not reach the or get shared in Chinese social media. So the power of China is another story that we're going to have to grapple with. It's going to be the story, of the next 50 years is what to do about this superpower that is really operating outside of the norms of modern democracies.
Jim, we end each session with a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about as it relates to the scientific community and the media?
Yeah, so first of all, it sounds like I'm blaming scientists for the situation. I think there was an effort by a small group of scientists to suppress this discussion. The good news is there were a lot of other scientists who kept pushing. There was a particularly impressive woman named Alina Chan. She's a postdoc at the Harvard MIT Broad Institute. She doesn't even have a job yet. And yet she did this long series. She published papers and wrote long, fascinating articles, and now a book all about the lab leak theory. Very, very brave, very independent. She wasn't the only one. So even on this topic, there were a lot of people doing great work. And as you see, we lost a year, but we ultimately got to where we need to be in terms of looking objectively at the question. We probably won't get an answer, but at least we're looking at it. My optimism comes from everything else that happened. I mean, you know, in every field, I've done a lot of work on ventilation, air quality, whether or not the virus is aerosol. You had so many scientists from other fields dropping what they were doing, focusing on this, getting together, writing papers, doing things that really had an impact on public health, had an impact on our understanding. And then the crowning jewel in that, of course, is this really miraculous effort to get these vaccines out in, you know, in maybe half the time that most experts thought it would take. And the efficacy of these vaccines is just so stunning. It's such a, you know, that's a really, really impressive story. An impressive story about not just science, but a really smart collaboration between private industry and the resources of the federal government, the public-private partnership. We get so much criticism of Big Pharma, but these guys did something really miraculous. And the government did something that only governments can do, which is you know, bring on the resources and the planning and the logistics to make sure we got not just had the vaccines invented, but manufactured in huge quantities. I'd like to see the U.S. government continue to invest heavily in this. We should be sending these vaccines everywhere around the world as fast as we can. You know, if it costs us $80 billion to vaccinate the world, that's a fantastic investment that we're doing it, but we should be doing it even more aggressively. So I'm optimistic that there's, you know, we have resources, we have smart people, and we will be better prepared next time, you know, one of these things hit. So it's a guarded optimism, but it is optimism.
Jim, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, it's my pleasure.